I'm going to talk about church hurt, and I want to say a couple things before we get into that. In order for me to talk about church hurt, what I'm going to ask you to do for the next hour is to hold some things in tension, because honestly, that's what church hurt is. It's managing the tension between things that don't belong together, trust and harm, betrayer and expectation of care. This is what we thought the church should be. This is what it actually was. We call that ambivalence, and it's that feeling where we have two feelings at the same time that don't normally fit together, but they are residing together in our heart, and it is really difficult for our brains and central nervous systems to know what to do with ambivalence. It's hard on it. So if church has been a place where you have felt close to God, and church is a place where you have experienced betrayal, it's really hard for your brain to figure out what to do with that. And so before I go on, is this okay? The mic? You guys good? Hear me? All right, cool. I'm going to give a couple caveats throughout the night. Here's the first one. I love the church, and I have given my life to it. I've taken vows to a bishop. I've said that I'm going to serve the church. So all this comes from a place of deep love for the church. I've also been doing a lot of study and preparation. I have a lot of young clergy that are in my orbit. And so we think a lot about church hurt and how do we use the power and authority that's been granted to us so that we don't harm people. I'm going to do three things. I'm going to help you understand what church hurt is. That's going to take me about 15 minutes. So you're like, hey, are you still talking about church hurt? Yes. 15 minutes to help you understand what it is. Then I want to show you a place where it shows up in Scripture. And then I will close by asking, like, how do we drop the baggage of our church hurt? How do we follow a shepherd that leads us perfectly? So I'm going to start with a great Anglican, not reformer, but just a great Anglican pastor. His name was Richard Baxter. He wrote a book called The Reformed Pastor, and he wrote that book in 1656. So when he's writing this book, it's just a period of intense religious, political, social upheaval in England. It's the aftermath of the English Civil War. It's a time when the authority of the monarchy and the authority of the Church of England is being challenged. They're looking at their leaders and saying, none of you seem to have our best interest in mind. And Richard Baxter looked at the pastors who were leading churches in England, and what he thought was, you, pastors and clergy, you don't seem to have your people's best interest in mind either. And so as he wrote The Reformed Pastor, what he wrote about was widespread pastoral neglect. He was very concerned about a lack of serious personal engagement by clergy. There's an entire like 50 pages devoted to how do you make a home visit, because clergy just didn't seem to know how to show up at somebody's house. It was written as both a theological treatise of what does a pastor look like, but also just a very practical manual that they didn't have, calling ministers to deep self-examination, humble service, earnest pastoral oversight. So Baxter's own earnestness is revealed in the way that he writes the dedication to the book. I just want to read it to you. Brethren, I crave your pardon for the infirmities of this address. I love an author who begins like, you might not like this. It's going to fall short. And earnestly longing for the success of your labor, I shall daily beg of God that he would persuade you to those duties which I have here recommended to you and would preserve and prosper you therein against all, and don't miss this, the serpentine subtlety and rage that are engaged to oppose and hinder you. Your unworthy fellow servant, Richard Baxter. I think what he got was like, the pastoral job is hard, but it's hard because we have a real enemy that's against us. So serpentine subtlety and rage, it artfully describes the devil, but it also describes the different ways that we can get convoluted and bent in our understanding of what's happening in the church. So recognizing the way that this can go badly, Baxter devoted a chapter to the sin of pride. And really, he excoriated pastors about the way pride shapes the way they do what they do. And I'd like to read this part to you as well, and then we'll get into something that's in this century, I promise. But you're going to hear a lot of F's, like it's just old English. Hang with me. One of our most heinous and palpable sins is pride. Yet it is so prevalent in some of us that it inditeth our discourses. It chooseth our company. It formeth our countenances. It putteth the accent and emphasis upon our words. He didn't really write that. It fills some minds with aspiring desires and designs. It possesses them with envious and bitter thoughts against those who stand in their light or hinder the progress of their reputation. Oh, what a constant companion, what a tyrannical commander, what a sly and subtle insinuating enemy is this sin of pride. It goes with men to the draper, that's the guy who would make your hat, and the tailor, clothes. It chooseth them their cloth, their trimming, their fashion. And I would that this were all or the worst, but alas, how frequently does it go with us to our study and there sit with us and do our work? How often does pride choose our subject and more frequently still our words and our ornaments? God commands us to be as plain as we can. We are informing the ignorant and convincing as serious as we are able that we may melt and change hardened hearts. When God charges us to deal with people as with their very lives, this cursed sin, pride, controls all. The warnings about the catastrophic consequences of pride are actually relevant in every generation of pastors. What Baxter longed for his colleagues was that as they dreamed of bigger platforms and more fame, when they envied the praise that other people received, when they chose their clothing to draw attention to themselves, when they let pride shape their sermons and their pastoral care, he wanted them to be aware of what sometimes comes unconsciously to make it conscious, and that they might go in a different direction. Because when pride is driving the bus, there is great clergy failure, there is church hurt. So what I want to do is present some present-day examples that reflect Baxter's warnings about the effects of pride on the pastor's ministry in general, and how the pastor uses power and authority in particular. So when he calls what he calls the results of pride, it's actually described with different words in different contexts. So when he describes pride as a constant companion or a tyrannical commander, we'll look at a king who failed in his leadership because he was afraid of the people. And when Baxter tells pastors to be wary of the pride fills them with envious and bitter thoughts, I'll talk a little bit about narcissism in the church. And when Baxter worries that pride will cause preachers to only say what congregants want to hear rather than challenging you to holiness, I will suggest that this pastoral tendency towards people-pleasing can create environments that are ripe for spiritual abuse. So let me start with a couple case studies. A couple summers ago, I sent out a request. There's about 1,700 people who get my rector's newsletter. And I was noticing there was a lot of people that were coming to Restoration who would describe their experience at the church they were leaving as one where they had experienced spiritual abuse, they were hurt by something. And so I was trying to understand, what exactly did you experience and how are you not going to experience that here, most importantly? And so seeing enough of those in my one-on-one conversations with people, I just did a blast. And I said, hey, if you're reading this wherever you are, would you, and if you would be open to telling me your story, you could use this form and just do it anonymously on a Google form, or I'd be happy to have a Zoom call and just listen to it. I was inundated. It was more than I could handle. I actually turned my Friday afternoons and I would just have 30-minute blocks and I'd take six every Friday for about 4 months. So this is a woman named Zoe. She was a single woman in her mid-20s. She responded to this request. She'd become deeply connected to an older couple in her church. a couple named Jenny and Bill. By the way, none of these names are their real names. They were in their mid-40s. They drew Zoe, the single woman, into their household rhythms. They invited her on family trips. They encouraged her participation in childcare. They involved her in Jenny's women's Bible study. Zoe was at their home multiple nights each week and was spoken of as one of their own. And you can imagine that probably was filling something that Zoe really needed. Now, Jenny and Bill were also best friends with the lead pastor of their church. I'm going to call them George and Christine. They, George and Christine, had a large family. They had seven kids, and Christine often leaned on single women in the church for help with childcare for their family. And so Zoe became one of the mid-20s women whom Christine would call on frequently. At first, Zoe welcomed the inclusion. She valued the sense of belonging and family, but gradually the requests increased. She told me that at one point she had driven these kids from where they were at home to one place, and while she was there, Christine had texted her and said, "Actually, I need you to come get this other kid and take them to this other spot." And she felt like, "This is too heavy for me. I feel less like a friend and more like a vendor." She started to wonder whether her singleness was being treated as, quote, availability for everybody else, rather than as its own God-given calling that made her precious. So Zoe shared with a trusted female friend, also in her church, her dilemma. Should I confront the pastor and his wife about how I feel? That friend, instead of supporting her, told Jenny and Bill directly and offered her own commentary. Her friend said, "Zoe's talking badly about you around the church." Very early on a Monday morning, Christine texted Zoe, demanding that she come to her house. Zoe showed up at 7 a.m. as asked, and she was physically shaking. She walked into the kitchen. She's so nervous. She got a glass of water and then immediately dropped it, apologized, scrambled to clean it up, all while Christine was glaring at her. Jenny and Bill confronted her harshly, believing that she had been spreading stories about them. And they demanded that she admit that she was 100% wrong. And Zoe quietly responded, "I will not apologize for feeling used." During that conversation, Zoe acknowledged that she had actually sought out Bill. So remember, Jenny and Bill were the first couple that she was a part of. She had gone to Bill, this family that she had been a part of in the church, who was also a deep friend of the pastor. And she asked him, "You know him, you know the pastor. Should I tell them how I feel?" And Bill had advised that she not. That upset Christine and George a lot. So Christine reaches out to Bill's wife, Jenny. The two of them tag team and have another conversation on Zoe, explaining to her all the ways that she was wrong. While they're talking, Jenny, who had been her discipler, brings up private matters that Zoe had shared during their discipleship conversations. Jenny accuses Zoe of bribing Bill because she bought him a coffee when she asked his advice. And in front of Zoe, Jenny verbally really processed Zoe's character and all the things that she did wrong. Zoe was disoriented. The people she trusted most in the church had banded together against her. She had admitted to feeling used and taken for granted. Here's what happened. In the weeks that followed, Zoe was socially isolated. The pastors, George and Christine, told people that they were not allowed to talk to her. She was cut off. Christine called her every day to see if she was ready to apologize. She also called her every other people to check in to see if Zoe had told other bad things about her. As Zoe sat in my office, she described herself as shriveling up and deteriorating. She was willing and waiting to feel convinced she'd done something wrong, but she never felt the Spirit's conviction that she had. How do we treat people who want to serve? One of the beautiful things about the church is that so many people want to come and use their gifts. They want to donate their time. They want to volunteer. And so many places where people get hurt by the church is when they feel taken for granted and used. Do we treat people as blessed holders of gifting, or do we treat them as free labor? How do we honor unmarried people in our community? She's deeply hurt. Here's another story. I call it insensitive and impatient. It was a Friday afternoon, and a lead pastor tasked a few team members with the job of designing compelling visual displays about the new budget for Sunday's congregational meeting. One of those people came and told me this story. All three of those people responded simultaneously with like looks of dejection and exasperation, like, how are we going to do this? It's Friday afternoon. It doesn't matter if you work for the church, if you work for the federal government, something on a Friday afternoon, that's hard to get. The pastor, as usual, when they noticed that they were reticent to say yes, lectured them about the mission of the church, the important things that God was doing in the church. We got to tell this story about what God's doing, and I need it ready by Sunday. And then he reminded them that he was the one who had to preach. He would do two baptisms. He was going to have to lead the meeting. The least they could do is put together this creative presentation, and so they relent and do it. However, as we know, life happens sometimes, and even though they said yes, two of the three had circumstances that kept them from doing anything on the project. So the third person, the one who showed up in my office, this person fell into such a panic that she texted the pastor with her regrets. She said, I just can't do it. They're not going to be done. And she was surprised because he was very understanding. He said, oh, I get it. It's fine. On Sunday, when the pastor gave the presentation, he smiled. They got to the budget part, and he stated in a passive, aggressive tone, unfortunately, Jan, Melanie, and Jeff, none of their names, were responsible for designing the visuals, but they didn't get the job done. They were sitting here, and so he winks at them and says, perhaps we know where the budget cuts are coming this year. No yelling, no cursing, but this deep cut of pain. Just a public dig that left those three feeling anxious, confused, ashamed. Story after story after story. Narcissism. Narcissism is a word that describes a deeply corrosive pattern that really thrives in ecclesial settings. You'll find it anywhere, but it loves when show up here. There's a clinical diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder, and sometimes church leaders have it, but more common is the way your run-of-the-mill church leader, the way they project confidence, vision, charisma, when beneath the surface they might be emotionally wounded, full of shame, afraid of being exposed. So Chuck DeGroat, in his book, When Narcissism Comes to Church, he uses three features that are associated with a clinical diagnosis of narcissism to illuminate patterns that more broadly happen in church settings. One is that there's just a pattern of grandiosity and attention seeking, like they want to be noticed. There's an impairment in empathy and intimacy, like nobody can get close to them. They don't seem to know how to get close to anybody else. And there's this unwillingness or inability to know themselves. In ministry, for the pastor, it means that you, the congregation, become a mirror that gets held up to him or her every single week to validate her identity or his. The church becomes an extension of their ego. Its ups and downs leads to his own or her own up and down. There's some characteristics that you might have seen. All decision making centers on them. Their impatience with other people who might not be able to get things done as fast as they think they should be able to get them done, which is that second case study. They delegate without giving proper authority, or they delegate with too many limits, or they delegate but they don't really give it away. They feel entitled. They feel threatened by other people who are talented. They always need to be the best or the brightest in the room. Addressing these kinds of patterns is notoriously difficult for a church. In fact, the reason why this thrives in churches is because we actually reward people for their charisma. We like a leader that appears confident and certain. They tend to be believed. We have very few ecclesial pathways for confronting narcissism, especially when a vestry feels a little conflict-averse or overly dependent on that leader's success to bring people in. It's real hard to tell him that he's wrong. Narcissism is a subset of a larger problem that we would call spiritual abuse, and this is how I define that. Spiritual abuse is the misuse of pastoral authority through manipulation, coercion, shaming, and forced silence that wounds a person's relationship with God, distorts the good news of grace, and protects the leader's power rather than the well-being of the flock. That's an aggregation of a lot of different definitions. But it's a misuse of pastoral authority. There's manipulation, shaming. It cuts at your relationship with God, distorts your understanding of grace, protects the leader rather than caring for the flock. Both of these, narcissism and spiritual abuse, are really misuses of power and authority. Power being the capacity to do something, to make something of the world, and authority being the moral right to actually do it. Here's my second caveat. This one's really important. Spiritual correction is not inherently spiritual abuse. This is where it's difficult to be in a church. This is where it's hard to be a pastor. Pastors are called to identify sin, to encourage repentance, and helping a parishioner recognize beliefs or behaviors that may be hindering their relationship with God, that's not abusing the person. That's often a critical aspect of the pastoral vocation. We have to do it gently, with respect, full of grace. But pastors are actually called to speak truth in love. In the same way, being strong and confident up front is not inherently narcissistic. The work of shepherding requires a pastor to stand in front and among their people. So we serve our congregations by saying, here is a clear path forward for us as a church. Here's where God is taking us. That's not narcissism, it's courage. So to be sure, spiritual correction is not the same as spiritual abuse, and clear leadership is not the same as narcissism. Yet, the consistent exhortation from Baxter, from the scriptures, from hundreds of years of church, is that we have to be vigilant against pride, against its corrupting influence on spiritual leadership. This is what church hurt is. Just gonna take a moment, literally a minute, just to be silent, let those things kind of land for you. Then we'll go to the scriptures. In the book of 1 Samuel, the people come to Samuel because they see him, and he was an amazing leader. He was strong, confident, close to God, and he had horrible sons. They had lived through the judges. There was a point for Israel's people where the assessment was like there was no king, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And as they saw Samuel and saw that he had actually helped them get some traction towards faithfulness with the God who loved them, and they looked at what was coming behind him, they come to Samuel and said, "We're done with the judges, and we're definitely done with your sons. They are corrupt, and passing leadership on to them is going to go horribly for us. Give us a king like all the other nations around us. Give us a king." We know as we read through chapter 8 of 1 Samuel that God was not pleased with this. Samuel was not pleased with this. God and Samuel get together and they talk about how sad they are that this is what the people have asked for. And God comforts and ministers to Samuel and says, "You know what? They're not rejecting you, Samuel. They're rejecting me. This is not going to go well for them." And Samuel goes to the people and says, "Yes, the king's going to take, he's going to take your sons, your daughters, some of your grapes, some of your land, some of your people. You're going to lose some of everything because if you get this king, it's not going to go the way you think it's going to go." And they say, no, it will, and we want it. Give us a king. So in chapter 9, Saul was the king that they wanted. He looked exactly like all the other kings. He looked like who you would think a king should look like. Physically impressive. He's described as there was not a man among the people more handsome than he. There was none like him among all the people. And at first, he was actually gracious. There were people who objected to him, and when he had some victories and was building his own traction of leadership, there were people on his side who came to him and said, "You should kill the people who were, you know, against you." Saul said, "Nope, I'm not going to do that. That's not the kind of leader I'm going to be." He lets them live. But he's also depicted in chapter 9 as pastorally incompetent. Literally, he is a bad shepherd. There's this verse where it says Saul was in charge of the donkeys and he lost them. He goes from the whole hill country of Ephraim. He passes through Shalisha, doesn't find him, goes to the land of Sha'alim, doesn't find them. It's really like, I actually like looked at a map from there and got the, it's a big 30-mile loop. It would be like driving from Alexandria to Springfield to McLean, all the way around the Beltway and then back down looking for donkeys, never found them. Just a little foresight of what's gonna happen with Saul as the leader. There's indicators that for all of his charisma and charm, Saul wasn't all that much interested in God. He becomes much more absorbed in the work itself. And honestly, the work as such didn't seem to suffer. He was devoted to it. After some initial victories, the stories are told in chapter 10, 11, 12. Saul actually gets hard-pressed by the Philistines. Because they watch what's happening within Israel, they get nervous, and so they gather everything they have for a initial push to wipe out this upstart King Saul and this pesky nation of Israel, and it freaks everybody out. The story gets told in chapter 13. Jonathan had attacked the Philistines, and they had responded by putting everything together that they could. In verse 4, In verse 4, it says, "And all Israel heard it, that Saul had defeated the garrison of the Philistines, also that Israel had become a stench to the Philistines. The people were called out to join Saul at Gilgal." And then in verse 5, "The Philistines mustered to fight with Israel. They had 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, troops like the sand on the seashore. They came up and encamped across the valley. And when the men of Israel saw that, they were in trouble. They hid in caves and holes, in a hole in the ground, in rocks and in tombs." Saul was still at Gilgal, and the people found him. They were trembling. You probably know this story. Saul waits like 7 days, just checking the clock. Where's Samuel? He's waiting for Samuel to show up. As much as he's the king, he knows that Samuel has this role with God, and he's waiting for him to come. Samuel didn't show in time. So Saul's like, okay, we've got to be ready. And what we need actually is for God to be on our side. The way we get God on our side is by offering a sacrifice. I'm just going to go ahead and take care of this and get the sacrifice offered. I know I'm panicking. I know I'm afraid, but I'm going to take matters into my own hands and I will offer the sacrifice. Almost as soon as the smoke goes up, Samuel arrives. And his first words to Saul are, "What have you done?" Saul runs through it. "Well, the Philistines were mustered at Michmash and the people were scattering and you were late. You were late. So I offered sacrifices to keep the people together, to get them ready for battle. And even though it appeared that, you know, it was motivated by the worship of God, Saul knows, Samuel knows that he's not really concerned with God. He's very motivated by what the people are going to think of him and what they're going to do. And so he uses worship as a means to gain success in the work, and he lets his fear drive his disobedience. And he allowed the people to loom larger in his considerations than God. That's what happens when spiritual abuse occurs. We let the people and what they're going to think of us, how they're going to respond, loom large. I wonder how you've been harmed by leaders in the church. I wonder if you've ever been hurt by a church. I wonder if you have a name, a face. I'm going to give you another couple moments to be silent. Just let the Holy Spirit draw that to yourself. You've got a lot of different data points of what that might look like. But I wonder if you've been harmed by someone in the church. It's inherent to our humanity that we actually want to be led well. Even if we feel like we want to be like a lone ranger, independent, on our own, work for ourselves, the king of our own particular roost, we want to be led well. Even if we are leading ourselves, we want a leader who has our best interest in mind, who's sacrificing for us, who's not sacrificing us. And so Psalm 23 is just this commercial for the leader that we have always wanted. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. It's this intimately personal pinnacle of what it means that a shepherd guides, protects, provides. In an environment where predators were frequent and food was sometimes scarce and water was hard to find, it's a remarkable summation that I have no needs because the Lord is my shepherd. He's the one leading me. In verses 2-3, the commercial goes on to how the shepherd guides. He leads to green pastures, still waters, paths of righteousness. The purpose being to restore my soul. He knows where to find pastures that are not only lush, but safe enough to be able to rest in peace. The metaphor of paths of righteousness being lush places of feeding and water, it's obvious that human members of the flock of God, of the Lord, would need guidance from their shepherd to find these places, and he would. In verse 4, the psalmist turns to the protection that the shepherd offers. Easily frightened by nature, the sheep are not afraid to walk through dark valleys and shadows. The rod, staff, comfort. Verses 5 through 6, David, the psalmist, actually shifts the image just a little bit to from a shepherd to a host. He provides a feast for a treasured guest, anoints my head with oil, cup overflows, surely goodness and mercy follows me. Just a vivid picture of what guidance, protection, and provision would look like. It is what we expect when we come to a church. We expect that we would be guided to places where our soul will flourish. We expect to be protected, to be told where the dangers are, to be given constraint that we wouldn't go there, to realize that we never have to be alone in the midst of it. We expect to be guided, protected, provided for, that we would hear things that are true, we would be fed at the Lord's table. This is what we expect when we come to a church. And when this is not what happens, it hurts. Ezekiel 34 is a picture of when it doesn't happen. It's God saying to people who were leaders, you are not protecting the sheep, you're actually consuming the sheep. You haven't looked for the strays. You haven't bound up those who are broken. You haven't run after those who are lost. You haven't brought them back. God says, I'm just so tired of it. I'm actually going to be the shepherd that they need themselves. He rejects them and says, I will step in and be the shepherd that they need. God sees you. He knows what you're looking for when you walk in here. He doesn't miss when it doesn't happen. He's kind when you feel ambivalent. He's patient with your leaders. I wonder how you would like your Psalm 23 shepherd to meet you in your hurt. Do you want to be guided, protected, provided for? How do you need this Psalm 23 shepherd to meet you in the places where you've been disappointed or harmed? The last place I want to share with us is why do churches allow hurt to happen? Because I think for people who experience it, that is often the question that comes to mind is like, how? Like, why would God let me go to a church where I can be hurt? Why would that church create a system where hurt can happen? Why is it not getting better? So let me just offer a couple things that are happening in churches around us, especially as these stories of hurt continue to grow. Most churches want a celebrity. We know that the way to make an organization successful is by finding an exceptional person to lead it, a franchise player for a basketball team or a really good preacher. And churches want someone who's strong, dynamic, and inspiring, and they will overlook a lot if they think that this person is going to be someone who can draw others here. So whether your church has 50 people or 500 people, we look for that person who just seems to be able to be magnetic, And sometimes we miss some stuff. Churches will surround that person with yes people. It's really hard to confront the pastor. And so sometimes when that pastor does something that hurts someone else, it is not in the interest of the system to actually remove that person from doing what they did. And it's really hard for a vestry to speak up against a pastor that they love. And when they're looking at someone who was hurt versus a pastor whom has done so much for the sake of the church, they often side with the pastor over the one who was hurt. And that puts hurt upon hurt. If the last 20 years have been marked by more and more stories of church hurt, it's also been marked by an unprecedented amount of criticism that's come at the church. And a lot of churches are just tired of being accused of doing wrong things. They circle the wagons. They don't listen to the victim. And sometimes they put the blame right on him or her. So if this is the church hurt that you've experienced, this is what I want to suggest and offer. This is what we do to drop our baggage, to maybe begin the process of healing and doing something else. First, I want you to recognize that when God made us in our bodies, he gave our bodies appetites that are really good. Appetites for food, for drink, for sex, for church, to be known, for community. And we know that each of those appetites can tip over into something that is not good for us. They can become addictions. They can be ways that we comfort. So one of the really difficult parts of the ambivalence of church hurt is that you actually need church. He can't walk out of here and say, I'm done, I'm never going to a church again. There is a gaping hole that ends up in your soul that you try to figure out, what do I do with this? So if you are in touch with your own sense of pain about church hurt, it's not something you can walk away from. It's something that your good, good shepherd needs to lead you into. So my first encouragement is to not try to numb it or ignore it. Secondly, if you're in this room tonight, then you have shown up in a church, and well done. And if you are now aware of some pain or hurt that you didn't know was there, sorry. And there's hope. So if you've been hurt by church, you don't have to go to the person or the church or institution that hurt you to get help. You can free to go to someone else first. There are lots of good pastors around here. I'm always available to help make a referral. Jamie could. But you don't have to go to the direct person that made life hard, harmed you. But there are resources and people within the church who would be willing to care for you and would actually be honored to walk alongside you. So don't ignore it. Know that there are resources in a church that could help. When you go to a place that's going to be helpful, the most helpful thing that they will do is you need someone who will believe you. Someone who will hear your story, say, yes, yes, I'm sorry. And then the church, if they're actually willing to face the way hurt happens, they need to find someone outside to inquire, someone to dig a little bit into what happened, someone to keep it confidential as the digging and inquiry happens, someone outside of the person who was hurt, the person who did the hurting, who is out there and can take a deep look into here. And then we take the time and we ask for the Holy Spirit to bring his healing. But those steps are the beginning. Those are steps that each of us can walk. We don't ignore it. We find a place where we can tell it. And we hope that that particular institution will look outside of itself to take a look into itself. I'll close this with what Jesus says about his own vocation. In John chapter 10, he said to them, "Everybody who came before me are thieves and robbers. Sheep don't listen to them. They know what a thief and a robber is. They don't listen to them. But I'm the door, and if you come in by me, you're going to be saved. And you'll go in, you'll be able to go out. You'll go in and you'll go out, and you will find pasture." There are thieves, and those thieves come to steal, kill, and destroy. They have bodies, they're enfleshed. They're spiritual. We have an enemy that wants to steal, kill, and destroy us. In contrast to the thief and to your enemy, I've come that they may have life and have it abundantly. It's my plan, Jesus says, for each of you. I'm the good shepherd, and good shepherds lay down their life for the sheep. They don't eat them. I'm the good shepherd, and I lay down my life for the sheep. Father in heaven, thank you for the ways that you know us. Thank you for this institution you call the church. As broken and imperfect as it is the vessel that you have provided to this world to show off your good news, gospel, and grace. So where it's wrong, would you make it right? Where it's broken, would you make it whole? Where it is sick, would you make it healed? And for those who have been harmed by the inadequacies and disappointments of church, would you, kind shepherd, find them, guide them, protect them, provide for them, heal them? I pray this in your name, Jesus. Amen.